I'm Alexander Heffner, your host on The Open Mind. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Angela Rasmussen, an American virologist, a research scientist based at the Center of Infection and Immunity at Columbia University School of Public Health, to our broadcast today. Thanks so much for coming on, Doctor.
Thanks for having me, Alexander.
Dr. Rasmussen, you are quarantining during this pandemic in Washington. And as we were discussing while we're getting the recording set up, you decided when Seattle was in fact the hotspot to quarantine there, but ultimately that was the most advanced story in addressing and mitigating the crisis, even more so than New York. When did you make that call? I remember Lori Garrett tweeting, you know, shelter in place, decide where you want to be for the next 6 months or maybe year, 2 years. And so when was that moment for you?
So that moment was really for two reasons. So one thing is that I'm based in Seattle as well as New York because my family lives here in Seattle. And I was already out here in early March. And at the time, Seattle was actually a hotspot. It was the biggest hotspot in the country. It was the place where community transmission was first recognized. And I felt that I wasn't sure how long I was going to be staying here, but I felt that it would actually be irresponsible of me as a public health professional and a faculty member at a top school of public health to get on a plane and go from a known hotspot to a place like New York City, which was not thought to be a hotspot at that time. And of course, you know, a few weeks later, the situation was not that way. And I was glad that I was not in New York City. Now, I mean, I think it would be probably safer, certainly for me to go back and forth between Seattle and New York. But cases have begun to increase again here in Washington as we've begun reopening, as they have to a much greater degree in other parts of the country. And so I'm, you know, bottom line, I'm relieved to be with my family because I don't know how much longer this is going to continue. I think, though, in general, it's probably pretty unsafe for people to be moving around too much if they don't have an absolute need to do so.
Let me ask you about your scientific expertise. Doesn't the period of quarantine or shelter in place really depend on the efficacy of a vaccine?
It does. And while it doesn't only depend on that, though, I should say, there are ways that other countries that still do have a low level of transmission have been able to safely reopen. And that is by flattening the curve to the point that community transmission is at such a low level that it can be detected essentially and stopped through standard epidemiological work, like testing people, routinely testing people, identifying people who are infected, isolating those people, doing contact tracing and testing their contacts and quarantining them. Those methods are really tried and true for stopping epidemics without completely eradicating them or without a vaccine. Unfortunately, in many places in the U.S. right now, there's too much community transmission to make that a feasible prospect. So really stay at home in those situations is the only way that we have right now without a vaccine to flatten that curve and get that transmission level down to the point where that test, trace, and isolate protocol would actually be practical to do.
Dr. Rasmussen, we hosted a couple of your colleagues in the epidemiological and emergency medicine space. They said on the podcast that given the half measures, but we wouldn't even call them half measures, but the incapacity of local and state authorities to effectively mitigate, that, you know, we are in a wild west of community transmission for some time, having tens of thousands of new cases and deaths repeatedly day after day. So in this environment, you know, the vaccine really isn't our Hail Mary. It's like the required social step because of the lack of heeding public health guidance and the lack of discipline in many states. So if you agree with that proposition, that based on the lackluster and in some cases non-existent heeding of public health, the vaccine can and will be effective At what point realistically, based on the preprints and what you've seen so far, or a vaccine?
Well, I haven't seen anything so far. And I know that phase three clinical trials have just started for many of the vaccine candidates that are being tested right now. So there really hasn't been any data to suggest when we will actually have a vaccine that will be available widely for everybody to access. You know, we really need, before rolling out a vaccine to the entire population, we need to be confident that it is effective as well as safe. And while the, you know, preliminary safety trials have been conducted and some limited preclinical studies that normally would occur before trials start, in this case, they occurred during those trials, have also been conducted, we have an indication that some of these vaccines are probably going to be effective, but we can't say for sure until those phase three trials are complete. And I haven't seen any data at all to suggest that we have even early indications in those trials that these vaccines are up to the level that we would need to begin manufacturing them at scale for the population. So I think at the earliest that we'll have any kind of vaccine, even for, you know, the highest priority people, and right now I'm not sure what that would mean. I think that's going to be a whole separate, probably contentious discussion that's going to happen when we do have a vaccine candidate. I think the very earliest we could have one that would be available even to some people would probably be very late in 2020 or very early in 2021. And I think that having a vaccine that's truly effective, that's truly able to induce herd immunity, probably at the earliest will be sometime later in 2021. But right now, because there really isn't data at the large scale to suggest how effective these vaccines are, we really need to just wait and see. And it's just kind of anybody's best guess as to when that will be. I think we all hope that it will be as soon as possible.
We hope it will be as soon as possible, but there is the possibility that the efficacy just won't exist, or at least it won't exist in the next year or two. The uniqueness of this coronavirus and the fact that we haven't really been able to address it, even though maybe the focus hadn't been squarely on addressing this in a vaccination. How can you differentiate the approaches to influenza vaccination and polio vaccination? Because it's not known, right, whether or not COVID can be vaccinated like a polio, or if it can only be vaccinated more like a flu.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I mean, certainly one possibility of any clinical trial is that the vaccine might not work. And that, you know, is a really awful prospect in terms of public health. It's really different situation than for both polio and influenza vaccine. So when the polio vaccine was made, it was considered an urgent public health crisis in the 1950s, because a lot of children every summer were becoming paralyzed by a poliovirus infection and paralytic poliomyelitis. It still took years to develop both the Salk inactivated vaccine and the Sabin live attenuated vaccine, both of which are used in different parts of the world today. So those vaccines, while they were rolled out as quickly as possible, still took years to develop. The influenza vaccine did take years to develop as well, but it really every year we have a new flu vaccine, or a trivalent flu vaccine actually, that protects against three different strains of influenza A virus. But that vaccine is basically just tweaked a little bit from the vaccine the year before. So we already know how those vaccines work. And we have years, and in those vaccines cases, decades of data supporting their efficacy. Now with the flu vaccine, we know that from year to year, sometimes we don't always guess correctly which flu strains are going to be predominantly circulating. So that is an example of a vaccine that has different efficacy from year to year, depending on how it's formulated.
What about the longevity of the antibodies, right? If you need the vaccine every year because the antibodies will only last for 6 months or...
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And inactivated vaccines tend to have immunity that doesn't last for quite as long. So the Salk inactivated polio vaccine, for example, you need to have a booster shot to maintain those antibody titers. And that's fine. And with flu, you sort of get a booster shot every year. It's just for a different influenza virus. It's really hard to actually unpack this with influenza because almost everybody's either had influenza or they've had flu shots before. And so sometimes it's really difficult to try to separate the protection you're getting from any given year's influenza vaccine with the protection that you have from those residual antibodies. And this gets further complicated with the fact that not detecting antibodies doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have residual immunity. So the cells that produce those antibodies, called B cells, do exist as memory B cells, and they can last for longer periods of time. So even if you don't have antibodies, those cells are still there. And if they're exposed to the virus again, they'll start making more antibodies. So it's really difficult to make conclusions about long-term protective immunity in terms of how it functions just based on antibody titers alone. But it's certainly a possibility that any vaccine we develop might not be completely effective at inducing what we call sterilizing immunity, meaning it completely prevents the infection altogether, or maintaining high titers of antibodies over long periods of time. And we may need to have booster shots, or we may need to come in with a, you know, imperfect vaccine at first that only provides some partial protection, and then follow up with a better vaccine that has been tweaked using one of the other many candidates that are currently in the vaccine development pipeline.
Right. So it does sound like best case scenario, there's a vaccine that is effective, but would likely require boosters. And even if it did have the polio level of efficacy and didn't need to be taken year to year, that the infrastructure to develop that would take several years to fully protect populations. But that leads me to the follow-up question, which is how likely, if at all, is sort of an equally plausible scenario that a therapeutic is invented that can address this?
So I think a therapeutic is really one of the wild cards in this situation. Having an effective, especially a widely available therapeutic that could be used to prevent disease, so a prophylactic rather than something that would only be given to the most severely ill patients, would be a real game changer. And that would actually buy us some time potentially for, you know, being able to make a more effective vaccine. I think the bottom line is the ultimate goal should always be a vaccine, because it's certainly better to be able to prevent the virus altogether. But I think if we are able to develop a therapeutic, especially one that can prevent people from progressing to really severe disease or can reverse that really severe disease, that would have a huge impact on how seriously, you know, we need, I mean, you should continue to regard the pandemic seriously, but in terms of the measures we would need to take, the seriousness of the stay home orders, continuing all these practices that have been so disruptive to our lives, having an effective therapeutic would really change that entire equation for the better.
And based on the raw science that you know better than anyone, you and your colleagues, tell us why there isn't a therapeutic right now that deals with the problem proactively, like, you know, just on a genetic level. Why can't we do that? And is it really feasible that we could? I mean, theoretically, anything is possible with new innovation, but why scientifically isn't there a therapeutic that addresses the problem? And is it really plausible that there could be one?
So I think it is plausible. I mean, I think some of this comes down to what kind of therapeutic is it? So the hydroxychloroquine, I think it still is in clinical trials to evaluate its efficacy as a prophylactic. So far, it doesn't really seem to work other than in observational studies, which are very difficult to make conclusions about because they're not properly controlled. And so you can't really conclude firmly that that drug is preventing people from getting severe disease. So I think it is totally feasible, though, that another drug like that, whether it's, you know, a drug that we already know about or a drug that is currently still in development, could be found that does prevent virus infection. And there already are drugs that probably would be more beneficial if given earlier in the course of infection. And that specifically, I'm referring to remdesivir. So remdesivir is a broad spectrum antiviral And it does shorten patient stays in the hospital, but that's when you're giving it to the most severely ill patients. And what remdesivir does is it drops viral loads. So if you have a patient who's in the hospital, they have already progressed beyond the point where dropping their viral loads is probably going to help them, because at this point, the severity of their disease is being caused by essentially uncontrolled inflammation and aberrant immune responses. So if you were able to give remdesivir at a much earlier time point, which I believe that Gilead is trying to do now in some of their clinical trials, you might be able to prevent people from progressing to that state of disease. The problem with remdesivir is that not everybody can necessarily use it as a prophylactic because it requires an IV infusion. It can't be taken orally. So it's not like you could just take a remdesivir pill every day and we could all prevent getting COVID-19.
And that's what I'm asking about, really, Dr. Rasmussen. What would that pill accomplish in terms of, you know, molecularly that nothing does right now? What would that kind of prophylactic that you pop the pill and once you start having symptoms, or, you know, alternatively, you have a regimen. I mean, the problem is that there's so many symptoms that overlap with cold and flu and other things that are, you know, it gets more intense. But the prolonged fever and shortness of breath, there are pretty unique hallmarks of this. So, I mean, what if you thought that you know, you had a cold, you would take potentially Motrin, Tylenol, Advil. If you thought that in this climate it could be COVID, what would that pill do in terms of reacting to the spike proteins that are COVID in your body?
So remdesivir actually works by blocking the enzyme that copies the genetic material of the virus. So it prevents the virus from making more copies of the virus effectively. If you went to a testing center and tested positive, but you hadn't developed symptoms yet, or if you had very, very mild symptoms suggesting that you were early in the course of infection, getting remdesivir at that point would lower your viral infection to the point that you might not end up getting sick. It would basically stop the virus from replicating. So this is similar to getting, you know, a urinary tract infection and taking antibiotics. It gets rid of the bacteria that are causing that infection and your symptoms get better. The problem with patients who have severe COVID is that, yes, they have a lot of virus replicating in their bodies, but they also have this cytokine storm that's occurring, which is essentially an out of control inflammatory reaction that is actually causing the tissue damage. So at that point, those patients don't benefit at all from getting rid of the virus, because that ship has already sailed effectively in terms of this harmful immune reaction that they're having. If you could get rid of the virus before it induced that harmful immune reaction, you would be much better. You would likely have patients with better outcomes because they would never get that sick to begin with. And that's sort of the concept of using remdesivir. It's a lot different than using like Motrin or Tylenol because those drugs just really treat symptoms and they don't do anything to alleviate the virus replicating, which is what causes this out of control immune reaction that I was describing. So,
can you contemplate, though, a pill that does address not just COVID, but future coronaviruses? I mean, is such a thing possible? It's not clear that it is.
I think such a thing is possible. So there's a variety of different strategies you could use to define something like that. You could look for common features of all coronaviruses, like a common process that they all need. Remdesivir is actually a great example of a drug that not only would theoretically target all coronaviruses, but all RNA viruses. It targets a very conserved, meaning shared portion of this enzyme that replicates RNA virus genomes. So it's been tried for Ebola, for example, and it has in vitro activity, at least in the lab, against a variety of different RNA viruses. So there's certainly that strategy. You could use a really broad spectrum antiviral or develop new broad or, you know, pan coronavirus drugs like that. You could also look for common host responses to the virus infection, which is actually what I study, and find the the common things that all people do when they get infected with these viruses on a cellular or molecular level and target those interactions. Because most people know that viruses require hijacking the host cell that they're infecting. If you can find the components of the host cell that it hijacks and disrupt that ability to hijack those, you might be able also to treat more than one virus as long as they're all using the same process to hijack those cells.
Are there
so
any
that
drugs
is a very active area of research.
In that area of research, your expertise, are there drugs being contemplated or experimented with to do that, to prevent the hijacking?
Absolutely. And I mean, it's thought that hydroxychloroquine was thought to work that way, at least in cell culture in the lab. Hydroxychloroquine does a few things, but it was thought that by preventing one step that the virus needs in order to complete entry into the cell and begin replicating, it was actually targeting the host side of that. And that's how hydroxychloroquine was supposed to work. The problem with that, and so it's, we should certainly look at those types of strategies, and I do myself, as well as many of my colleagues, that's an active area of research. But hydroxychloroquine is a good sort of cautionary tale that sometimes when you find those types of interactions to disrupt and you can do it in the lab, it doesn't always mean that it's going to be translatable into the clinic in a way that helps patients.
So when you contemplated the relevance of your expertise to the next decade, did you foresee how all-encompassing it would be? I know that there are folks who cover this beat who were warning of the next pandemic, but when we sit back and kind of reflect on everything you've just said, it demonstrates how integral solving this problem is to human society and to the preservation of life on this planet. You know, it's you know, very specific challenge medically speaking, but there's so many stages, and it really does seem like this is going to be a years long battle. Like if we thought that cancer we could cure in the next 10 years, obviously there have been innovations around cancer vaccinations and new treatment immunotherapies, but like this is a new challenge. Most of the American population and even maybe the health community wasn't anticipating specifically having to solve, but doesn't it seem apparent, as just a final question, doctor, that this might not be able to be solved for years?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly apparent. And I can tell you what my opinion is on why that is. So myself, my colleagues, all people working really in the space of emerging infectious diseases have known that it's not a question of when a pandemic is going to occur. If a pandemic is going to occur, it's a question of when that pandemic is going to occur. And already in my career, there's been one pandemic, or now two. There was the 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic. There have been numerous viruses emerging. So Nipah, MERS coronavirus, Zika reemerged, Ebola reemerged in places that we didn't think that it was before. There's a whole slew of viruses emerging. So we certainly knew that there are going to be more novel emerging pathogens, and that some of them may have the ability to cause a pandemic. And for that reason, up until the Trump administration, there were efforts to develop pandemic preparedness plans that brought in a variety of stakeholders, everybody from scientists to physicians to policymakers, et cetera. The problem with this has been, as long as really I've been in research, is that funding for this type of work has gone in sort of a boom and bust type cycle. So there's a new pathogen that emerges, there's a lot of funding poured into it right away, and then that funding dries up. So it's very difficult to do the sort of long-term continuous work that we're talking about to prepare for something like this and to prevent it from becoming a pandemic when there's just nothing to support that. And that, in my opinion, is the real problem with this. We've been really crippled in our ability to even anticipate these pandemics specifically. And so we were not well placed to respond to this one effectively. And it's certainly an active area of both research, policy, and advocacy to change the paradigm by which we respond to and anticipate these types of pandemics, and how we need to be better prepared as a society. And I really hope that we learn that lesson. Unfortunately, we've had to learn it the hard way from this pandemic, but I really do hope that we apply some of the really hard lessons we've had to learn to these efforts, so that we can prevent pandemics like this from occurring in the future.
Yeah, and into your mind, when you envision this nightmarish scenario, could there have been a worse outcome? It seems like there are so many unique things about COVID that like, you know, the way that it's sort of mysterious and not immediately treatable, diagnosable, certainly not curable yet, the way it paralyzes health systems. You know, it's been said that, you know, it's not as deadly as SARS, but it ends up having a deadlier impact on health systems, partly because of the scale and scope. But I mean, just as a final question, is there a nightmare that's even, you know, lurking beyond COVID that, you know, we ought to be preparing for, sort of the next one?
I mean, certainly there are, you know, influenza viruses. There are 25 or so families of viruses that can infect and cause disease in human hosts. And I think we need to be prepared for potentially any one of those to emerge. We don't necessarily know what's going to be the next big thing, in part because we haven't done enough surveillance to find out exactly everything that's out there. And also things like climate change, mobility around the globe, different cultures and the way that people are moving and using land and interacting with one another across borders, across continents. These all have really unpredictable effects, but they make it a lot easier to disrupt ecological systems and allow these pathogens to spill over into human populations. So we really need to be better prepared and prepared for anything.
Dr. Angela Rasmussen, thank you so much for your time today and for the really imperative work that you're doing every day.
Thank you so much for having me, Alexander. Really appreciate it.